We have one case to be argued today. It's a holdover from our sitting, I believe, in January or so. And it's number 20-1634, P&A Construction, Inc. et al., the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 825 et al. Ms. Lovelace, Messrs. Kilbert and Regan. Ms. Lovelace?
Can the court hear me at this time?
Yeah, we can. I can. Is that Mr. Kilbert or Regan?
This is Mr. Lovelace. I'm trying.
Oh, I apologize.
I'm trying to get my picture to work again. It's just cut off all of a sudden. It was working before.
Well, we hear you well, so that's good news. And I apologize for the name ended in A, and I was assuming the incorrect gender. My fault. We hear you well, so you can feel free to begin, Mr. Lovelace, whenever you're ready. And as long as we can hear you by audio well, things should go smoothly.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. To the court, this is Otiambe Lovelace. I'm counsel for P&A Construction and Utility Systems Construction in this matter. As requested by the court, today I'm prepared to start by...
Do you wish to request time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, Your Honor.
That's fine. And I take it you're the pinch hitter coming in at the last minute, because I think it was Mr. Toby initially scheduled to argue this. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. He had a surgery not a few months back, and he's been slowly recovering from that hip surgery. So I've subbed in and got admitted.
Not a problem. Not a problem at all. So you have 5 minutes rebuttal, and go for it.
Thank you. Okay. Today, as requested by the court, today I'm prepared to start by dealing with the issue that was asked of us to prepare for today, which was to determine whether or not the appellant's claims for tripartite arbitration has been dismissed or finally adjudicated by the district court, and whether this case is properly viewed as an appeal from a final order or dismissal. The appellants respectfully submit that the decision and order issued by the district court was a final decision and a final decision and final order that is appealable because the request for the tripartite arbitration award was effectively foreclosed and denied as a result of the opinion and order issued by the district court, and essentially resolved all remaining issues left in the case. Now,
wasn't there just also a stipulation to that effect that no further claims remain to be litigated?
Yes, Your Honor. So I was about to mention that. So while at the time the order was issued, there were still some claims remaining. The parties followed what we think is a procedure required by the Third Circuit, and we signed a joint stipulation, a consent order that stated therein that all the remaining claims were either dismissed or had been resolved by the parties, and that the only remaining claims was that pursuant to the Harmony Agreement and the tripartite arbitration, which were denied by the district court. This stipulation was signed.
There was an alternative stipulation that had been proposed by Local 825, and the language of that proposed stipulation actually would have dismissed all of the claims and dismissed the complaint. The stipulation that you initially put in, or your predecessor, and the version that was finally entered, that doesn't have that language. Instead, it indicates that there's an agreement to dismiss all of the other claims, but as to the claim for tripartite arbitration, that relief had been denied. But that one is not, by the terms of the stipulation, dismissed. What's the significance of the rejection of Local 825's language, which would have dismissed that claim, versus the stipulation that was entered?
Well, I can't speak to exactly why counsel and why during the negotiations of the consent order, why it may have been changed slightly during the process. I think that the overall goal of the stipulation was that it would be a clear acknowledgement from the court that there were no more issues remaining before the court to be decided. And I think that was required by the case law. For example, in Aluminum Company versus Baser E, that's a Third Circuit case, 124F.3D551, Third Circuit, it had a similar situation here. And in that court, the district court looked at whether or not the order is a final, looked at the effects, and whether or not the order is final depends on the effect of the decision. And here, the effect of the decision was that the ultimate relief that was being requested in the matter, which was a request for tripartite arbitration or harmony agreement arbitration, was denied, leaving there nothing else to be resolved. Specifically in the aluminum case, it pointed out that ordinarily a final decision will have two effects. First, the decision will fully resolve all claims presented to the district court. And then second, after the decision has been issued, there will be nothing further for the district court to do. We so feel that that's it.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, but please.
To be clear, in this situation, an alternative, since the basis for the district court's conclusion was that there was not a sufficient factual basis to view Utility and PNA as a single employer, to go forward and engage in discovery or make a further showing to the district court and then renew the motion once there had been some record development in the district court. So I take it what you're telling us is that that is not something that that PNA and Utility were or are seeking.
So that is, we would be inclined to a situation where this matter is kicked back so that we could further develop the record. But at the time,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but to pick up on Judge Krause's point, if you think of the original motion to compel arbitration as in the civil procedure space, let's just say it's analogous to a Rule 12b6 motion. Now, there's a lot of reasons it's not. It attached a certification, it did all these other things. But let's just think of it as being something like that. If a court denies a motion to dismiss on Rule 12b6, that's not the end of a case. There's still summary judgment, there might be trial, there might be other things. And what I infer Judge Krause to be asking is, well, just because you lost that motion that one time with the evidence that you had, doesn't mean the district court, you know, why not just come back? Why not say, yeah, you know, all we had was a Barrow certification. It wasn't a declaration. It wasn't an affidavit. It's pretty weak in terms of evidentiary material. Why not just say, yeah, we'd like to do some more digging. We come back and we can renew this. Mm-hmm. And so it really hinges at one level, finality hinges on whether your initial motion was kind of one bite at the apple among many that you would have, or if it was your only bite at the apple. And your answer, and the reason I apologize, but I interrupted you, was because if you want to be in front of us, you kind of have to say it was our only bite at the apple. But what you just said when you responded to Judge Krause was, we want more bites at the apple. And so it seems to me that if you want to be here, you have to say that was it. We were one and done.
Your Honor, if I may
now say we want more.
Your Honor, if I may. So at the time, please. We were hoping that we would have kind of multiple bites at the apple. That's why we didn't kind of go the order to show cause. But what we realized through the case law was that we had to be aggressive about this and appeal it immediately because there was a split in the circuit courts as to whether or not we'd be able to even apply for this request for tripartite arbitration later if conflicting awards had come out against us. As kind of developed in the briefing here, there is a split in the circuit courts whereas the Ninth Circuit requires you to move for tripartite arbitration and seek it out before the conflicting awards come out. And so we wanted to make sure we did everything we could appeal this because we could have been foreclosed when these conflicting awards came out. So we
but the second, the sixth, the 10th, and the DC circuits went the other way. And one could argue that that's a bit of a wrinkle here. They all five of them dealt with it on the merits. And one just says, before you get to the merits, you have to, as you know, with respect to the Ninth Circuit, it's a bit different than the other four. But does that really take away at this point that doesn't, are you saying your stipulation does or does not take everything else off the table?
The stipulation does take everything off the table according as far as we see that the matter was closed and the judge seemed to also agree that there were no issues remaining before her at that time.
So just to kind of complete that thought then, if there's nothing else for the district court to do, really all we're asked to do here, if it's truly final, and we can't send it back for more discovery or do anything else like that, we're basically asked to determine on the factual record, which includes a certification, not a declaration, not an affidavit, not authenticated documents, nothing like that. We're just asked to look at that record and find out if the district court got it right. And we aren't here to say, maybe you could do more, maybe you couldn't. If it's final, that's the only question that we have, right?
You would be right, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay.
All right. On the merits, is what is your primary argument there?
Okay.
Because you've got one contract with 15024. The other entity has a contract with 825. Utility subcontracts to P&A and purportedly did not follow 825's hiring procedures. Instead, it hired some of the 15024 workers. So what do we do?
So, Your Honor, here we feel that the lower court made a mistake here by applying the Emory factors and then holding us responsible to standards that I don't think had been completely recognized by the Third Circuit at this point. For example, we believe that the district court erred when it required us to somehow prove that it would be a foregone conclusion, or somehow inevitable that there would be conflicting awards. Whereas it seems to be, according to American Glass Cutters, Window Glass Cutters League, that all that needs to be shown is that there is a risk of inconsistent obligations being imposed upon the employer.
Well, we believe that I apologize because I know you're in the middle of a thought, but let me just push back on what you just said, because I don't think it's just a risk. I think there's modifiers to that risk, like substantial or other courts use different modifiers, but Emory, I think, says substantial. And then if we look at the evidence that comes forth, we've got the certification of Barrows, and in paragraph 12 of that certification, it says, as a result, plaintiffs are now engaged in two arbitrations concerning the same facts and circumstances with two separate arbitrators that could potentially issue inconsistent decisions. Now, I mean, when someone says to me that something could potentially happen, my brain doesn't instantly go to the place of saying, oh, there's a substantial risk of that happening. Could potential seems more like might, not likely to or overwhelming probability that. So even if the district court might have used a different formulation of Emory or something like that, I don't think there's any standard that I've ever seen that says could potentially is the new legally operative test.
I understand, Your Honor. Yes, the certification does use that language, could. I think that what is also important here is that we did demonstrate as well, though, that there was, in this matter, a 35-year collective bargaining history that would need to be examined by the arbitrators in place, whether it was the arbitrator for Local 825 or the arbitrator for 15024. The arbitrator
only one CBA is in the record. It's hard to establish like a kind of a dual tier analysis of arbitration history when only one CBA is in the record. It's kind of that's an ask, don't you think?
Yes, Your Honor, that is a bit much, but there are representations made to the court at that point by staff and ownership at the company saying that they were bound by these CBAs, and there was proof that there was an arbitration started concerning the CBA.
Why should we conclude that there's any likelihood, much less substantial likelihood of conflicting awards when the 825 award that's now been confirmed by the district court provided only retrospective relief? And in that situation, that's just a matter of paying for alleged retroactive violations.
Yes, Your Honor. The issue with the award that has already now been been set out, and which is what our concern was the whole time, was that the arbitrator would disregard the 35-year collective bargaining history and agreement that was in place between the parties. During the, you know, what one thing that was important that went on between these parties here is Local 825 audited the companies for every three years, for 35 years, and had no problem with this arrangement. New management came into place, it all of a sudden became a problem. And now, and one thing we did submit to the district court to show how all of this was interrelated was the audit request sent by the union's funds, demanding $3 million and classifying utility contractors and P&A as a related company. And
I understand that argument from your briefs, but let me just take you back to the extent that the only relief that is ordered in the 825 arbitral order is retrospective. How does that create a substantial likelihood of a future conflict with another arbitration award?
Okay, because what happens in these arbitrations is that, well, what we are expecting now is for the steelworkers, just as Local 825 has done, is to look back 6 years and send us an audit demanding money for all of the work performed by the two companies now that they'll be considered, you know, joint employers, or they'll be considered to have violated this work share agreement, or now the arbitrators now decided that there is no work share agreement. That is one of the issues now, that the unions and the funds can go back 6 years and use this decision that has now been put out to say that, look, all the work that has been done for the past 6 years was in violation of the CBAs, and we want contributions for the past 6 years. That is the law, that is what will likely come. And that is actually an arbitration that's still pending with the funds, where they're looking back 6 years and they're claiming that all of the work done by P&A, which is a signatory with the steelworkers, should be paid to them. They have actually done this now. They're saying that we owe them $3 million. The steelworkers, although they're saying that they're staying out of this at the moment, they still have 6 years to come after our employer and say, look, you owe us 6 years of pay for everything done by utility, that contractor that was signed with Local 825, because arbitrators have found that there is no work share agreement.
If that comes to pass, why shouldn't we just follow the path that they did in Emory and say, right, you know, if it's just a potential conflict, that's not sufficient, but at some future point where there is a real conflict, then you could come back.
We agree that the reasoning in Emory is well thought out, and that is a procedure that is fine to be followed. And we think that were this court to decide that the Emory factors apply and that they should be followed step by step and lined out, then we also would agree with that. We just felt that the Third Circuit hadn't completely adopted that standard or set it forth explicitly.
Yeah, you're going in a direction I want to ask you a follow-up question on, which is kind of the absence of a lot of Third Circuit law in this space. You referenced that your clients were in a hard spot because there was a circuit split on some of these issues. I'm sure you had to counsel them on which circuit to follow and which circuit not to follow. That's always hard. But one of the things I don't think the Third Circuit's even said is that tripartite arbitration is okay. We've never even endorsed that. The most that we've done is maybe say dicta, and we've enforced tripartite arbitration when a CBA or two sets of CBAs already contemplated it. But I don't think we've ever actually crossed that first river, which is saying that tripartite arbitration is acceptable in the absence of provisions in both relevant CBAs that say it is. And, you know, I mean, a lot of the other circuits say that's okay. But that's a really, really bold result that's kind of unique to the labor law space. If a business has contracts with two other entities, not for labor, but for parts, and they make a bad contract where they overpromise, they might be subject to dueling judgments, retroactive, maybe even specific performance. But we don't make both those parties go to arbitration with them. We don't compel a non-party to the contract to go to arbitration. So just taking a step back and saying, maybe we are writing on a clean slate. Why should we even begin to go down the road that the other circuits have gone down in recognizing what is really an extreme form of relief, compelling a non-party to an arbitration agreement to submit to arbitration.
I think the reason that this should be done here in this case is that for the best interest of the men involved, the men and women involved, the companies involved, and finality on the jobs. What happens here when we have these jurisdictional disputes in labor cases is that one union will be assigned the project and another union will come in and say they claim that work, and it will effectively shut down. It can shut down the project. It could cause individuals to be laid off for a substantial amount of time and delay large public work projects, private projects. We think that this process of getting all the parties together in one room and resolving it all at one time, if the unions claim the work, let them all air it out in front of one arbitrator at one time, and then we put it all to bed. And that allows the projects to move forward.
I'm gonna jump in here. You reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and we've already gone 20 minutes rather than 10. So why don't we hear from Mr. Kilbert and Regan, and then we'll get you back on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Kilbert.
Good morning, honorable judges. This is Richard Regan for Local 825. With the permission of the court, Mr. Gilbert and I had discussed it. I was gonna go first, if that's okay with the court.
That's fine, no problem.
Yeah, thank you, Judge. Judges, with respect to the, you know, the threshold issue of finality, I think the whole idea of the stipulation from Local 825's point of view was to make sure, in fact, we were getting some finality, and basically utility and P&A weren't kind of, you know, half in, half out, kind of, you know, basically keeping all of their options open. And I think the intent of the finality is really clear. I believe, Judge Phipps, you alluded to it, is, you know, in the motion for the supplemental record, you have the decision of the arbitrator. And as you pointed out, it's only retrospective. But beyond that now, to bring you up to date, the utility, not, you know, P&A, moved to vacate the bilateral arbitration award. We moved to have it confirmed. And the district court, Judge Wigginton, in fact, confirmed it. I think their participation and them taking the initiative to vacate it kind of reflects that they saw that they weren't going to avail themselves of the options that I think you alluded to.
Wait a minute. You got to clarify something for me.
Sure.
You signed a stipulation on April 1st of 2020 saying that everything's off the table. Then your reply brief, you argue that we do not have appellate jurisdiction to review the district court's denial. Isn't the motion to stay arbitration moot because these proceedings have already ended?
Well, I think it is moot, but I don't think that was our position in the reply. I think that might've been the steelworkers' position in the reply.
I'm looking at Local 825.
Okay, I don't quite remember saying the lack of jurisdiction. Because obviously we didn't cross appeal on any issues.
Maybe you limited it solely to the Harmony Agreement. Is that it?
Yes, the Harmony Agreement. We didn't think there was any basis for the Harmony. I wasn't going to take time to address the Harmony Agreement unless there were specific.
No, I have no questions on that.
Yeah. So I think with respect, you know, our intent was to make sure that they weren't, you know, trying to have it both ways, so to speak. And I think it's clear that they made a tactical strategic decision to just go with what they had with respect to on the union's issue on the bilateral arbitration. You know, as Judge indicated, you know, there were many things that they could have done. They could have tried to amend their complaint. They could have tried to embark upon discovery. They could have tried to bolster, you know, the thinnest of thins, you know, what they contended on the joint employer and the single employer was.
Let's just, when you get to the merits, if we decide, were we to decide that the employers are a single or joint employer, P&A and utility, how does that affect our Emory analysis?
I don't think it, you know, that the impact on the Emory, one is, I don't think those concepts were intended to basically be a shield for employers to evade their contractual responsibility with their respective CBAs. Here, you know, you have two distinct CBAs, two distinct companies. Utility has a CBA through its basically assignment of all its negotiation rights to an association, the Construction Contractors Labor Employers of New Jersey. They essentially have decided to assign away their rights. And P&A has a separate CBA contract with the steelworkers, 15024.
Are you arguing on the record that they're not single, there's not a single employer or alter egos here? Or are you arguing against tripartite arbitration as a whole?
Two things. One is I'm saying they didn't submit any evidence that the district court could have concluded even remotely that they were joint employers or single employers under any of the guidance that's out there. Whether you go back to Judge Garth's opinion in the NLRB, you know, Browning-Ferris, and in there you got to understand, once again, the joint employer doctrine was being invoked to basically solidify the liability of the two companies. It wasn't being put forward as a device to exempt them or exempt one company from its contractual obligations.
But let me just ask this question. At one level, I get that for tripartite arbitration, there would be need to kind of establish a common employer, either through the joint employer doctrine or the single employer doctrine. And what you're saying at one level is, look, they haven't done that. The evidence is insufficient of that. But as I read our circuit's law, we haven't really endorsed compelling tripartite arbitration. That's an open question. We've enforced tripartite arbitration agreements, but we haven't compelled it. So there's an ask here by P&A that we advance our federal common law in the labor space to allow tripartite arbitration. And the rationale given is to bring everyone to the table who's going to affect the situation. But that rationale applies regardless of whether P&A and utility are joint employers or single employers, because what they're saying is it's a set number of jobs one way or the other. So at one level, if the common law is in play to advance and the rationale or the policy for advancing it is to bring everyone to the table, who cares if they're a single employer or a joint employer? It could be quadrilateral arbitration. As long as everyone's at the table and we prevent labor unrest and we have peace for the workers, why don't we just go that far with the common law?
Well, that's going pretty far. And you actually, you know, you stole one of my lines. I was going to say, we don't have here a request for tripart arbitration. When you look at it and you analyze it, it's really a request for quattro arbitration. And look, I don't think that this case really takes us beyond windows glass cutters. I think in that case, we're, you know, I believe, yeah, who authored, I know Judge Gibbons was on it, is, you know, it kind of alluded that, you know, upon a proper record, maybe you get to the point where you decide the tripartite arbitration, whether this circuit, our circuit, wants to go in the direction of, you know, this the second, the sixth, the 10th, the DC circuit, or does it want to go on the outliner way of the ninth? The other thing that I think, you know, basically, you know, members of this panel have long recognized that arbitration is a matter of contract. And you said that in farmland. And here you have contracts. The contracts are the CBAs between one employer, one union, a totally separate employer and a separate union.
But that doesn't beg the question. Tripartite arbitration, as other circuits have recognized it, is a triangle involving a single employer.
Correct. Right?
Yep. And so, you know, if we assume that the evidence here were sufficient to show that we had a single employer, I take it you don't oppose the idea of this circuit embracing tripartite arbitration and the Emory factors in principle. It's that it's simply inapplicable on these facts. That's your argument, right?
If I could, two things. One is, I think, as you said, on a proper record, given the trend, is there might be a case that comes before this court where it should decide the issue of tripartite and then decide how it wants to shape it. And if it were to do that, or were to use this case for that occasion, I think it should shape it more along the lines of the Sixth Circuit in Kroger, with a combination of Emory Freight. But I think it really should be, there should be conflicting awards. It shouldn't be a premature. It certainly shouldn't be a risk, a hypothetical risk of a conflict. I could see that you could have a condition in there where it's a traditional single employer with two unions that it's signed, two different CBAs with, where the employer is then assigning work assignments, for example, as you know, like, okay, you know, who's going to use the freight loader to move boxes from one union or the other, you know, where once you have one bilateral award, it's got to be pretty apparent that it's going to pose a conflict with that employer's CBA with the other one. So you could, you know, perhaps tag on to it something where you don't necessarily need two, you know, completed bilateral awards. But I certainly don't agree with the Ninth Circuit idea that you do this before there's even a single bilateral award. And I think there should be conflicting ones. And basically, you know, this
the other circuits, I think, do require it after you have conflicting awards issued.
I agree, Judge Ambrose. And
Sixth Circuit. Isn't really your best theme that this is a matter of discretion for the district court?
It is.
It's not an abuse of discretion.
It certainly is not. The bottom line in terms of at the end of the day, when I close in summary, it's going to be, you know, regardless of what test you were to apply, Second, Sixth, D.C. Circuit, 10th, even the 9th, on this record, the district court did not abuse this discussion in two ways, and denying the request for judicially compelled tripartite arbitration and rejecting the notion that these two employers had demonstrated to the court that they are joint or single employers.
Is there anything else you wish to add before? I've got an argument right after this.
If you have a specific question for me, judges.
No, I do not. If not, we'll hear from Mr. Kilbert. But my colleagues, I ask you if you have any further questions.
Can I just ask briefly, the district court has now confirmed 825's award. Is there an intent to appeal there? And is there any reason that we should hold this case for that appeal? Would they affect each other in any way?
Well, there's no intent on the union's part to appeal, I can tell you that, Judge.
Your Honor, if your question is directed to the appellants, they want to appeal that, yes.
Well, all right, we'll come back to you. Do you see, yeah, Mr. Regan, any potential conflict there that suggests we ought to hold this case if there's to be an appeal?
No, I don't. I think there's an established procedure, under a Title IX arbitration. And I think the grounds for appeal are very, very narrow there. And I think that if Utility elects to go down that road, it should go down that road with its eyes open with respect to its frivolous appeal or not.
All right. Why don't we hear from Mr. Kilbert, and then we'll go from there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, judges.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'd like to first address the issue of jurisdiction as requested by the court. The appellants here filed their appeal on March 16th, immediately after the district court issued the award denying their motion for tripartite arbitration. At that point in time, the appellants still had on the table claims for injunctive relief against the operating engineers relating to restraining them from filing further grievances or exercising economic pressure against P&A to reassign.
So is that why you had the April 1 stipulation?
So I think that that's right, that the April stipulation should have the effect of ending the proceedings in the district court and converting this appeal into appellant's one bite in the apple.
At this court's order on April 2, it says the ultimate relief has been denied. There are no remaining claims. I mean, Is there anything else left to do?
At the district court level at the present time, no. At the time that the notice of appeal was filed, there was.
No, I got it. So it was filed on the 16th, but you cleared it up 2 weeks later.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So let's say we're dealing here with a final order. I mean, normally, if we were to embrace a new standard and announce new law, we would remand for the district court to have the opportunity to apply that and for record development if needed. If in this case we are to conclude precedentially that that tripartite arbitration is viable under Section 301 and that the Emory factors apply, why shouldn't we then remand, as appellants have requested, for the district court to apply those factors and allow for record development?
So, Your Honor, the district court did apply the factors from Emory, and appellants had every opportunity to argue those factors. They cited to Emory, they cited to other circuit courts relating to the concept of tripartite arbitration, and they frankly made no effort whatever to develop a factual record sufficient to carry the day on any of those.
Let me just interject here, which is, you know, there's a lot of different type of remands, right? They come in a lot of different shapes and sizes. One sort of remand is for additional fact finding, right? And another is because there's a new standard of law. We don't need any new fact finding. We just would like a district court to take the first crack at taking the pre-existing record and applying the new standard to that pre-existing record. And so to the extent that Judge Krause's question can be kind of fractioned into different pieces, why at a minimum isn't, if we announce a new standard, it appropriate to remand to the district court to, without any new fact finding, just apply that standard to the pre-existing record? Or is that something that we should do because it's just a pure question of law?
Your Honor, I do think that it is a pure question of law at that point. So you wouldn't on appeal give any deference to the district court's first crack at it. But if this court, for a good and sufficient reason, determines to remand this, we would submit that the appropriate remand would be to apply whatever standard this court articulates, should it choose to articulate one, to the facts as they were developed below.
Any further questions of my colleagues? If not, then thank you. And we will get Mr. Lovelace back on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Lovelace.
Thank you, Your Honor. One thing I'd just like to point out is I do think that, kind of in line with what Your Honor Judge Phipps was saying, that there are different types of remands. In this case, it does seem like it would be appropriate to remand the case back if this court does decide that the Emory factors should all be addressed and that Emory is the controlling law, should be referred back to the district court to reconsider its decision. However, I also would add—
Well, the district court discussed three of the five Emory factors.
Yes.
And didn't discuss two of them.
But I was just gonna add that I think that if that is going to be the standard that is going to be accepted and recognized by Third Circuit, and that is now being said—
Is there really anybody that hasn't adopted the Second Circuit's Emory factors?
Only thing I'm saying is I just believe that if that is the standard that gets adopted now, it being, you know, April of 2021, that the appellant should be given an opportunity to brief this issue, knowing full well that the Third Circuit requires that standard and requires that those factors be addressed.
The district court did adopt those factors and believed that it needed only to deal with three of them in order to rule, in favor of the other parties. So is your point that
My concern is here, as we pointed out before, that with the wrinkle that one of the judges pointed out, with the wrinkle of the Ninth Circuit, you know, there's this issue that, yeah, we didn't have a complete record and maybe we could have stayed in language.
Well, what if
which longer the Ninth Circuit says, adopted the reasoning of the Ninth Circuit, we could have been foreclosed here. So I think that is kind of the wrinkle in the issue that's presented here.
But if we don't adopt the Ninth Circuit, then what happens? In other words, the Ninth Circuit basically is held that employer, you know, you must seek tripartite arbitration before it's subject to conflicting awards, but it appears that the other circuits say that you can seek it after conflicting awards are issued. Isn't that right?
That is correct, yes.
And so what if we just go with the four that the Second, the Sixth, the 10th, and the DC Circuit?
Well, I think that would be fine if the court decided to do that. My only concern is of equity and fairness to the litigants. The court would be adopting a standard requiring evidence
What is inequitable here as to how the district court operated in choosing to look at the Emory factors, find that three were relevant enough for the court to make a decision and go from there? What was inequitable?
Well, the court also pointed out in its decision that we had failed to go through and present evidence about every single Emory factor. Had we known that that was going to be a requirement of the court, as the court pointed out in its decision, we would have done that. But it was not the standard that was required by the Third Circuit at that time.
Counsel, didn't you assume as much? I mean, you argued the Emory factors in your own briefing.
We will fully admit that we assumed that we were unclear. We were unsure about what circuit court would prevail in this. But yes, we did address the case law that we found online. Upon that. Yes, Your Honor.
But I guess, like, you know, usually if someone is uncertain about what it's going to be, they, you know, and I get your point. Your client's in a tough box because there might be a little tension between different circuits, and that just makes your job and your client's job a lot harder. But usually when someone's uncertain, they tend to put in enough proof that would meet whatever the test eventually is. You like, least common denominator is not always the best legal strategic response to uncertainty in the law. It's usually kind of all denominators are met, not least common denominator. And so to the extent that there was uncertainty that made your and your client's job harder, why did you go with the least common denominator approach as opposed to kind of the cover all the bases approach?
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, but I think it would be unreasonable to expect attorneys and clients to cover all the possible avenues or ways that it could shake out. The district court actually required us to address the Emory factors. But what I'm saying here is that the court could have chose some other case. It could have chose some other circuit case or decision and went off of that. And then could have said you were required to address XYZ standards. No, how would we have known?
The point is, it sounds like you're making a due process argument. The district court wanted to have addressed, I suppose, the Emory factors. You did address them. The court did address three of the five, thinking that was enough to be necessary. Where is the possible due process violation here?
Okay, let's see if I can find the decision. One second.
Counsel, could I ask you in the interest of time in the interim, whether you agree that a contractual nexus is a prerequisite for tripartite arbitration under Section 301? Hasn't every circuit that has adopted tripartite arbitration done so in the context and been explicit about the requirement of contractual nexus?
Yes, I think in this situation, we feel that the contractual nexus is required because that's what's getting everybody into arbitration. But we feel that is also established here because these companies, and even as Local 825 has shown in their audits, they're holding these companies, both companies are being held liable for damages under Local 825's agreement, and both companies will be held liable for damages under Local 15024's CBA when not arbitration.
So for you to be entitled to tripartite arbitration, given our agreement that a contractual nexus is required, it rises or falls with your proof of utility and P PNA being a single or joint employer.
If that is the requirement, yes. Yeah.
And can I just ask one? This is probably at least my final question, but can an employer be both a single and a joint employer, or is that really an either or formulation, either a single employer or your joint employers? But I'm at least struggling conceptually with how you could be a single employer. We're all just one, but then we're also joint as well. Maybe that's an obvious question to the assembly of labor law knowledge that we have here, but at least to me, those struck me as being in tension. What do you think?
Yeah, they can't be different. The issue here is that what we're saying is that in these labor arbitrations, the case law is kind of going to shake out that they're going to be found as both a single employer and a joint employer because of how they operated their business. It was just one company. And as the facts kind of show, it was just PNA. Then they opened up utility just to appease and kind of make this agreement but work out a resolution.
But I guess my point is, isn't joint employer like the fallback? Like, isn't your real argument that they're a single employer?
Yes.
And then if they aren't a single employer, well, then because of how they operate their company, they should be viewed as joint employers. But I guess what I'm asking is, as a theoretical matter, you aren't saying they're just one company who's actually two. You're saying that they're first treat us as one company. If we don't meet that test for some reason, then we want you to import another test from NLRA to LMRA that's joint, and we meet that test. But I think they're best viewed as substitutes, not complements. Is that right?
Yes, that would be correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Jalal, I heard you answering Judge Ambrose's question, and you were looking to the text of the opinion for where there could be a due process violation.
Yes, I was just pointing to footnote 6 on page A5 of the appendix. The court, Judge Wigington, points out that plaintiffs have made no showing with respect to the remaining Emory factors. And she puts that in there. If that's how the judge felt, and that is the standard, and that's what we're required to show, I think we should be given an opportunity to
But both employers cited Emory in their briefing to the district court to support their motion to compel arbitration. And Local 825 expressly addressed Emory. And so the court addressed three factors and is saying that, in effect, you did not address the remaining factors. Therefore, the court won't either. And I suppose the argument there that might be you would claim an abuse of discretion, but it's hardly a due process violation.
I was just using it as an example for why, in this court's wisdom, it may want to remand and allow the appellants to fully brief that issue, because it is something that, I do believe this was an abuse of her discretion to even adopt and require us to apply the Emory factors and then brief it all out. But in terms of responding to your due process, I do believe that she's requiring it, and we were not given notice that we had to address all of the Emory factors.
Let's assume that you're bound to the record that you have, having chosen to appeal at the time you did. Some of those Emory factors include that the collective bargaining agreements have to be compatible, right, in terms of their procedures. How could we make that assessment, or say the district court was in error when the agreement between PBA and Local 15024 isn't even in that record?
Understood. I think that this would require the court to remand it with further briefing to actually address all the Emory factors. I think that things like that, like the CBA with the steelworkers, could easily be attached and incorporated. And I think it's something that can be resolved. And it could be briefed properly, and then the Emory factors could be addressed in this, and the district court can make a decision applying Emory to this case.
Well, can you give us an offer of proof? Say we did remand. What are the additional facts that you put in the record to show that the Emory factors were satisfied?
Okay. All right. So if the record was to be reopened, we think we would include additional certificate. Well, first, let me pull up the Emory factors. Okay. So at this moment, if we do apply, I think one, we would be able to show that there is actually a arbitration award that's been issued. You can see on page, on the final page of her decision, she points out that there are no conflicting awards, nor is there an arbitration award at the moment. Something that's changed now is that there is at least one arbitration award that seems to conflict with the requirements that utility P&A have in compliance with their CBA with the steelworkers. Let's see.
Can I just ask this? If the record's reopened, would you put Ms. Barrows up for testimony and cross examination?
Yes. We would also subpoena maybe records from the steelworkers concerning this history of the history between the parties, the agreements between the parties. We would also include certifications from workers that were part of this whole arrangement, that were part of this work share agreement for 35 years, that understands how the parties kind of went across this relationship. One thing that's clear in labor cases and CBAs is that CBAs are not defined strictly by the text that's therein. The collective bargaining history is also included in the CBA. And that's something that's acknowledged by the court. We would go further to brief that, to acknowledge that the collective bargaining history that can be established through further testimony and certifications and affidavits could then demonstrate that the work share agreement existed.
All right. But the fact that the work share agreement existed, how does that show that it was a single or joint employer relationship?
Okay, understood. Yep. We'd also be able to show the relationship between the two companies, show common management, show common location, show common offices, show common administrative procedures, show that they always worked on the same projects together for 35 years. We would also be able to show they had the same ownership and the same management team. All of this is information that we could further develop in the record if it's sent back. It's something that Ms. Dita Barrows alluded to in her certification, but we could further develop that if it is sent back. These are facts that aren't really in dispute, and it's facts that 825 is relying on too, and their audit against us seeking $3 million and holding the companies as being the same.
All right, so thank
we definitely think that we could further
develop. Thank you. I know we said we give you 5 minutes, we gave you about 14.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Your Honor.
It's an important enough case for the parties that it deserves the time. Thank you to all three counsel for being with us today, and we'll take the matter under advisement.